Hi, I'm Petronella Armedic. You know, when I was asked to do this year, I told my friend over there that I was doing it, and she said to me, "Oh, that's really brave, talking in front of all those people." And I said, "No, it's just the same as speaking to three or four people in a room." And I want to say now, Maggie, you were right and I was wrong. It isn't the same at all. It feels quite terrifying. And, you know, I've done a lot of shares over the years. And I remember doing the first one ever. And I think I did talk for much longer than 40 minutes at the time, because once I started, I couldn't stop. And then I went home covered in shame, not just about what I said, but about the fact that I've shared for too long. So it's nice that I've been invited to speak for a bit of a longer time this evening. And I was thinking when I was sitting here and, you know, seeing this thing about the microphone and the recording and everything, and thinking, is that extra scary? And I don't know if it is really. I don't know if the recording makes any difference. But what I was thinking about was when I was using at one point, when my daughter was about, 9 months or 10 months old, I ended up, and I don't even remember how this happened, but they made this Channel 4 program about addiction. And, this was in the 80s, and it was all a big deal at the time, you know, junkie mums and all that kind of stuff. And these people who are making the program said, "Oh, you know, we want to present a different view of how it is and how addicts can be good parents." And I thought, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I can be. I am a good parent, and yeah, everybody should know it. So I ended up on telly on Channel 4, telling everybody not only that I was an addict, but that I was an addict mother. And you know, they came to my house and filmed. And at the time, my housekeeping skills weren't as well developed as they are now, obviously. And the way that I managed that situation was I cleaned up the room that they were going to come into, and the other rooms in the house were all absolutely filthy and, you know, full of paraphernalia and drugs and dirt and just general chaos, because I never did any cleaning. And I thought that I looked convincing. I thought I made a good argument for how it was possible to be just perfectly normal, take heroin and be a mother. And you know, the next day they had a phone in, and everyone phoned up and said, "It's really terrible. That woman's bringing out that poor child, and you know, look at the state of her. She was practically comatose," and all this kind of thing. And I was so offended. And it was true, of course I was. Because, you know, to be interviewed for the telly, of course I had to get really stoned. I mean, I was all the time anyway, so it didn't make a lot of difference. But, you know, how you say to yourself, "Oh, well, you know, I'll just have a little bit, and, you know, so that I can be sensible." And, of course, that never happened. So I was, you know, gouching as I was being interviewed. And you know, I've suspected since I've got in recovery that those people really knew what they were doing, and that they knew I was going to make a show of myself like that. I don't know. But do you know what? I was thinking about it. I was so desperate to be heard. I so desperately wanted people to listen to me that I would do that. You know, shame myself. Go on telly. Let the world know that I'm an addict. And at the same time, I was desperately shy and terrified. So I had a bit of a problem, really, because I couldn't actually cope with being around people or deal with people in any way, but I needed attention. And, you know, that kind of represents the dilemma of a lot of my life. And, you know, now I was saying to some friends before the meeting about how at work, I'm often in quite big meetings where there's a lot of different colleagues or people from other organisations, and where there's people, you know, from all kinds of backgrounds and so on. And I'm quite able to speak up in the meeting and raise a question or debate a point or disagree with somebody. You know, I can do that stuff now. And I couldn't do that stuff when I came into the rooms. I couldn't do that stuff growing up. I couldn't do that stuff at school. I couldn't do that stuff anywhere without a drink or a drug. And then when I had a drink or a drug, I didn't need to do any of that stuff because I was never in a situation where it was called for. I was usually comatose. So when we talk about a bridge to normal living, for me, this is part of what it means. It means that through coming to meetings, through talking to you guys, through talking to my sponsor, through working the steps, and just doing the things we do in NA, I have learned how to live. And not only to live, but to actually do these things that used to terrify me. Do the things that I never thought I could do. Do the things that I was envied other people for being able to do and resented them. And one of the things that I've learned how to do is to turn up and do what I've committed to do, whatever I happen to be feeling or going through at the time. And also to do things like this. You know, when I'm asked to do service, to do it. When I was asked to do this share, I did have a moment of doubt. Because the reality is, at the moment, I feel like I'm going through the hardest time, or the most traumatic time. Actually, I've been through harder times in recovery because I didn't have the tools to deal with how I was feeling. But I have had a really difficult time over the past couple of years, actually, but recently it's been very intense. And I thought, can I do that? Can I go and speak about that? Can I go and, you know, be in bits? And I thought, yeah, of course I can. That's the message, isn't it? That's the point. But whatever happens, I don't have to use, and I can carry on and do what I need to do and be a responsible and productive member of society, whatever. And that's an amazing gift, actually. And, you know, it's not even just us addicts who can't do that, usually. There's a lot of people that can't do those kind of things, but most of them don't have this fellowship. They don't have the gift that we have. You know, when I first came to NA and people would say, oh, I'm really grateful, I'm an addict, I'd think, what a mug. How could you be grateful for that? And now I really know what they mean. Because if I wasn't an addict, I wouldn't have this fellowship. And in fact, one of my sisters, at one point, when I was early in recovery, said to me, oh, I really envy you, because you can go to those meetings. And at the time, I thought, oh, God, you know, what's wrong with you? And, you know, what's wrong with her is she's really not very well and has her own problems and hasn't been able to go somewhere like this to deal with them. So, yeah, it's difficult to know. I was just sitting here tonight thinking, oh God, this is so difficult, because I feel like at the moment I am just a seething mass of paranoia, resentment, grief, anger, rage, in fact, not even just anger, and self-doubt, and I'm kind of sitting in front of you and I want to tell you how well I am and how great I am, and I want you all to think I'm really wonderful. So it's a bit of a dilemma, really. But I have to come here and just say how it is. And I'm really amazed, actually, that I'm able to do this now. Because when I first came into recovery, I remember when I was in treatment and I felt like I'd never be able to get it. Not that I knew I didn't want to use drugs again, and I was quite, I thought I could not use drugs, but I didn't think I'd be able to get the other stuff, because I felt too frozen, too locked up inside myself to be able to do the other stuff that people talked about, you know, the reaching out or asking for help or trusting people or accepting love or friendship, or even, you know, the stuff like when people say to you, just pick up the phone and call somebody if you're feeling bad. And, you know, I remember sitting in my flat at that time when I you know, 6 months clean or something, and sitting there with the phone in front of me and doing this kind of movement with my hand where I kept reaching out to the phone and going, oh no, they won't want to hear from, oh no, I can't do that. I could call someone, no, she won't want to hear from me. And having this kind of stuff going on in my head, whole dialogue, and never actually making a phone call, because by the time I'd convinced myself not to, and you know, it'd be much better to go and eat something and watch something on the telly and, you know, whatever, because that's much better for you than phoning somebody, by the way. And I didn't think I'd be able to do what I needed to do. I didn't think I'd be able to be real with people. And you know, I have recently, very recently, over the past few weeks, had a real insight into exactly why and how I ended up like that. And I want to talk about this because it's really big for me. My father committed suicide a few weeks ago, and I had formed a relationship with my father since I've been in recovery, and I've been in recovery nearly 20 years, so it was quite a long-standing relationship, but it was always very difficult. You know, my father's a very troubled person, and I've been very feeling about this, and I'm still in the middle of it, really. I feel really fragile. And, you know, what feels really difficult about this for me is that there are so many things about my father and my mother and how I grew up that all my life these things have been, you know, it kind of reminds me of that Mike Leigh film, Secrets and Lies. That's what I grew up with. And I think that was part of this shell that I built around myself, that I thought it was really impossible to allow people to know who I really was. Dangerous, in fact. And I've been dealing with the fallout from some of those secrets and lies over the past few weeks. You know, I'm the next of kin, and my father had written a suicide note to me, and I had to go over to Ireland and do all the stuff that you do. And one of the secrets that I've lived with and that my father's kind of imposed on me, I think, in the past 25 years or whatever, is that my father was transgendered and lived as a woman for the last 30 years. And the people in Ireland didn't know that it was my father. And when I went over there to deal with the stuff, they were all going, oh, I'm really sorry about your mum. And what do you do with that? No, because I think what I have lived with to some extent is shame. You know, I knew when I came into recovery that one of my major issues was shame. I felt ashamed of who I am. I felt ashamed of... It wasn't even thinking. It was just that's. I knew there was something really unacceptable. And, you know, there are lots of other things about my father and my mother that are really kind of... It feels to me that they're really strange and unacceptable and wrong. And my father and my mother met in a psychiatric hospital. And, you know, for me, I used to joke about that to people. I used to go, oh, isn't that funny? It's not really funny at all. The reason why they were there is because they were both very sick people. And then they both constructed different personalities for themselves. And neither of them was able to be present for me or my sisters. And... you know, I grew up with a lot of strangeness and a kind of neglect and abuse and all kinds of stuff that I didn't know. I didn't know whether that was my stuff or their stuff. And I grew up and I didn't repeat exactly the same things, but I repeated some of the patterns, you know. And this whole thing about about having this kind of false persona, like my father had, and my mother did as well. She actually used to assume different personalities in order to perpetrate frauds. And, you know, when I was using, I changed my name. When I had my daughter, my daughter's father was somebody that I kind of went off with. And then I came back to my long-term partner and we decided we were going to bring this daughter up as his, because that's what we wanted it to be. And, you know, we were addicts. So whatever we want the world to be like, we're going to make it like that, because it's not okay if it's not how I want it to be. And so we decided that what we'd do is we'd change our names so that we all had the same name. So, you know, I did the same thing. I assumed a different personality, and actually I thought I was really kind of punk, because I got my name, my surname, not my first name, that I was given that name. I got my surname off the back of a record album, and I don't know if any of you guys here know of The Only Ones, but they're like a kind of archetypal junkie band, and we thought, yeah, that's the name we want, you know, that glamour of junkiedom, a kind of wasted youth. And, you know, ironically, I ended up in a police station in Old Street, I think it was, locked up with that man's wife, because there was it was some kind of major drugs bust, and we got involved in business with them. And it just seemed like, oh, isn't that strange? But really, it's not. It's just like, of course that kind of thing's going to happen, because if you know, it's like my ambition was to be as much of a junkie as I could be, and that's what I achieved. And I suppose that is indicative of the determination that we have. And, you know, I was in a meeting last night, and I was talking about the courage and the determination and the persistence that we have to get into recovery and to stay in recovery. And I think when I was using, I showed all that, but I showed it in a really destructive way. I used it in a really destructive way. I used it to become as degraded and as addicted as I could. My main objective when I was using was to be unconscious. Or not really to be unconscious, to be as nearly unconscious as possible while still remaining conscious, because I didn't want to miss out on the bus. So I wanted to know I was stoned, but I didn't actually want to know anything else. And you know, sometimes by delicately balancing the combination of drugs, I achieved that. In fact, there was somebody I met years later in the rooms who said, oh yeah, I used to know you, just come around your house. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. And he said, no, you wouldn't, your eyes were always closed. Which would be kind of all right if I hadn't been the mother of a small child who needed me to be conscious and awake and present for her. So somehow I created the same thing that happened to me, not in the same way, and certainly not with intentions of doing so, but I neglected and abused my child just as I was neglected and abused. And I had another child, and she died when she was a baby, and it's her anniversary in a few days' time. And I feel really sad about that at the moment, but I feel like I couldn't be the mother that I wanted to be. You know, even when I had my second daughter, at the time when I was pregnant, I decided I'd have to have her adopted, because I knew I wasn't even looking after the daughter I had adequately. And it was actually kind of a survival thing, because I thought, if I just have the one child, then maybe we can stay together. Maybe I can hold it together enough for her. But but if I have another one, I know I won't be able to do it. I'm just going to fall apart. So I was going to have her adopted, but she died when she was very young. And of course I felt responsible for that. And who knows? I was using a lot of drugs, and I don't know why she was born with heart defects. And, you know, my response to that was to use a lot more drugs, because that's what I knew how to do. And when I got into recovery, I had to go through a grief process about that. You know, it was some years on, and I had to actually acknowledge the child that I'd lost, because I couldn't do it when I was using. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really conscious of at the moment, is that at the time, I did have a funeral for her, but I didn't organise it. You know, my partner's father actually organised it. And I turned up for it. And then I never went back to get her ashes. And I never made any memorial. Because that's how my addiction was. I wasn't able to face up to anything. And I couldn't face up to the pain of having to go and do that and think about, oh, I've got to do something with the ashes. So I left her there. And it was only when I was a few years in recovery that I was able to go to the cemetery and actually go there on her birthday and honour her memory and take that child back into my heart and own her. And, you know, for years when people said to me, how many children have you got? I'd just say, oh, I've got one child. And now I say, oh, I have two, because she is my child. And it feels like this is right to be able to acknowledge her. And the reason why I'm saying I'm thinking about that is because I have now got my father's ashes and I need to do something with them, and I'm organising a memorial for him. And thinking about what I'm going to do, scattering these ashes. And you know, one of the problems that my father had was he was an addict and an alcoholic who couldn't find recovery. And I think one of the last things that he did was try to seek treatment for addiction. But he did it in such a way that he made it impossible for himself, because he was living in Southern Ireland, which is a very Catholic country, and he was a violently atheist. And when he applied to the treatment centre and they said, oh, well, we've got a spiritual element to our programme, you know, that was totally unacceptable. Now, to me, that's so typical of what we do to sabotage ourselves. Reach out and make it impossible to have what we need. And I feel really gutted that he wasn't able to, you know, that he died in the agony that I know, because I know that agony from when I was using, and thank God I didn't have to live in it till I died, because I thought I would. I did think I'd have to live the whole of my life using drugs. I didn't think that there was any alternative. I didn't know how there could be an alternative, because I tried to stop using once, and I didn't have a program, and it was so horrific, I really thought I can never do that again. And, you know, I used drugs every day, even when I was in prison, until I finally put the drugs down. And thank God I've never had to use again after that time. And, you know, when I went into that treatment centre, and it was some time ago, and they weren't very common then, and you didn't have any care managers or anything like that now that helped you get into treatment. It was all a bit random, really. Or maybe it wasn't random. Maybe I was looked after. And I forgot what I was going to say about it. Oh, I was going to say, when I went in there and they said that thing that they say, I don't know if they still say it, but, you know, they say about, you know, in 5 years' time, only two of you will still be clean, or something like that. And at the time I thought, well, that's ridiculous. why would anyone throw this away once they'd found it? You know, how would anyone not want this? The reality is, I don't actually know anybody. I do, I know one person who is still clean and sober from that time. I know a number of them are dead. The reality is, most of us don't make it. We're really lucky that we're sitting in this room. We really are the fortunate ones. And you know, I say that despite feeling everything that I've been feeling recently. I still know I'm really, really lucky. And I've been able to do things in the last however many years that I thought I would never be able to do to make up for what happened when I was using, you know, to make amends. Because when I think about my daughter who died and my other daughter who suffered so much from my using, I used to think, I can't do anything about that. I can't make amends for that. And what's happened for me is that I've been given opportunities to do things for other children who've been affected by addiction. And I fostered my niece for a couple of years, and because her mother's really sick. And you know, that was really hard. She was 12 years old. She turned into a really angry, hostile teenager. And I took her into my home for this time and kind of battled with her, really. Battled with her to let her know how much I loved her. And eventually, I had to make this terrible decision that... take her to France so she could live with her dad, and she didn't want to go because she wanted to stay, well, for whatever reason. Not because I didn't want her to stay with me, I would have loved her to stay with me, but because she was, things were becoming very bad. And, you know, today on Facebook the other day, she'd sent me this message saying, something about, my favourite auntie, I really love you, and do you remember when we did this at Easter, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, she didn't even speak to me for a year after I took her to France and made her stay with her dad, because she was so angry with me. And now she's... And I didn't think she would get to the stage where she'd say, oh yeah, I see you did that for the best. And, you know, it's only a couple of years later, and she does. And I have another child in my life, my ex-partner's son, who I've really been involved very closely in bringing him up since he was born, and both of his parents are still using addicts, and they've gone out of his life. He lives with his granddad, so I usually have him at weekends, and he's 9 now, and I've made that consistent commitment to this child. And I love him so much, and he brings so much joy into my life. But the other part of that is, it feels like I can make up for what... I can't give my daughter her childhood back. I can't give my other daughter her life back. But I can do something for these other children. And it isn't that I do it and I feel like, oh God, I'm so great, I'm such a saint. I do it and I feel so much joy, and I get so much from doing that, and I also have gratitude that I'm able to do that today. In recovery, I've bit by bit, step by step, I have, like the other speaker said, I've made a different life for myself, because the life I had before, I wouldn't want back. The life I had before led to me having to use drugs. It was either that or kill myself. And I wouldn't want to be in that space, in that place that I was before. I've got a very different life now. And I've really fought hard for it. You know, when I first came to this fellowship, my daughter was 6. I had to leave my partner because he wanted to carry on using and dealing. And he's still doing that today. And so I was suddenly a single parent of a very angry, 6-year-old, and I got a job. Well, I'd done jobs in my using, but nothing legal or moral. And I heard the thing that it says in the literature about becoming a responsible and productive member of society, and you know, I'm quite kind of, I don't know, literal-minded about some things, and I thought, oh, right, that means I've got to go out and get a job, like, now. And none of that, oh, you know, take things slowly and whatever. So I went out and got this job, which, through very dishonest methods, I ended up with a job working in the NHS in a kind of junior management position, and I'd never done a job in my life, and I was terrified. And it was so hard. It was so hard going to work every day. I felt like shit. I felt really exhausted. I was depressed. I was deeply depressed because all the stuff that I'd never dealt with when I was using, all the trauma that happened while I was using and the trauma that happened before I was using came up and hit me when I put the drugs down. And you know, I was going to work and, you know, I'd never even had a sleep pattern in my life. It was, I'd get stoned enough to fall asleep somewhere, not usually in bed, just wherever. And so I had to really learn how to do these things, learn how to go to bed at the right time at night, learn how to get up in the morning, learn how to make a meal every evening, learn how to go to school and collect my daughter, because most of the time she didn't get to school because I was too out of it to take her. And I had to really learn how to do even the smallest things and you know, even things like when I got into recovery and I used to I remember being around somebody's house and seeing their skirting boards didn't have dust on them and thinking, how did they do that? I don't even know how they do it. I didn't know how to keep my house clean. I didn't know how to clean my teeth. I didn't know how to do any of those things. I had never been taught them when I was a child, and I didn't bother to do them when I was using. You know, if I had, in fact, my then partner's brother was a dentist, and he once said to us, oh, well, it's probably better if you just clean your teeth really thoroughly once in a while. And we took that to mean, you don't really need to clean your teeth, but just as long as you do it, like, once every few months, really thoroughly. Which is a real addict way of looking at things, I think. And so I had to learn to do those things. And you know, sometimes I still go to bed, into my bedroom, and I think, I don't want to clean my teeth. I can't be bothered. And usually, unless I'm really in trouble, usually then the well bit clicks in, and, or the program kicks in, and I go, okay, better go and do it. You know, and what, it takes 2 minutes? So I had to learn all this stuff, and some of it I learned just being in meetings and people would talk about how they lived or how they did things, or, you know, I heard somebody say something about that thing about paying bills, and she said, you know, it's not even a moral thing, it's just that then you get peace of mind, you don't think somebody's going to come and knock on your door. And then, you know, I'd had the experience in recovery of the TV license people coming and knocking on my door because I didn't have a license, because I thought, how can they expect me to pay for something like that? Don't they know I'm an addict in recovery? And yeah, you know, things are really hard for me. It's really tough. I can't be expected to do these things. It took me a long time to realise that, you know, normal life rules apply to me just as they do to everyone else, and that I'm responsible for me. And I'm responsible for what happens to me. It's not about them out there. And I always thought it was them, whoever they are. Recovery has been a process of learning that as well, that I'm responsible for what happens to me. What I put in is what I get out. And you know, I have put a lot in recovery. I have done those things that were suggested to me. And the first thing that people suggested to me was, whatever happens, you don't have to use. Just don't pick up. And you know, there were other bits that people added to that, which were the things about going to meetings, getting a sponsor, working the steps, and all the other things, becoming honest. But that thing was really, really important to me. I'm so grateful that somebody, or a number of somebodies, said that to me when I was just in recovery. Because, you know, sometimes these days there isn't that certainty about it. Maybe not in the fellowship, but I know, you know, people talk about, oh, well, you know, addicts have to relapse, it's a disease of relapse. And I think, well, actually, it doesn't have to be. You know, I was given that another gift, which was I was told, you don't have to use again. You never have to use again. You never have to do this again. And I never have had to use it again up to this point. And it's not been an option for me, even with all this stuff that's going on. I don't want to use drugs. What good's that going to do? It won't make things better. You know, I worked hard at getting a sponsor and working the steps. To be honest with you, it is only very recently that I've worked my way through the 12 steps. I spent many years getting stuck on step 5, leaving my sponsor and deciding that didn't work, and starting all over again because I couldn't deal with that kind of committed, intimate relationship. And I have relatively recently worked through those 12 steps with my sponsor, and I know now why it's really important to work the 12 step. And you know, there is something miraculous that happens when we do that, and it's been so for me. And one of my primary defects that came up over and over again was fear, that I avoided things, I avoided people, I lied, I was dishonest through fear. Fear you wouldn't like me, fear that I would make somebody angry, or fear that you'd leave me, or fear that I wouldn't be acceptable. And since I've done those steps and worked on that, actually not even worked, prayed for that defect to be removed, because that's another revelation I had when I worked the steps. I can't do anything about my defects. And it actually says it quite clearly in the book, but I'd never heard it in 18 years. I'd never heard that it says we cannot remove our own defects. That's what the higher power is for. We have to pray to have them removed. And I really believe that that defect is beginning to recede for me, and it's changing for me. And some of what has changed for me is this stuff that I've been going through recently. I've been able to reach out to people more than I ever have. I've been able to be real more than I ever have. I've been able to let people know more than I ever have. So I have worked really hard for my recovery, and I've worked hard in recovery, and you know, I think you need to give me another 40 minutes now because I need to say about all the rest of the stuff. You know, the other part of my life is that my daughter's now grown up, and we have a lovely, lovely relationship, and she got engaged this year, and on Wednesday we were planning her wedding, and I said to her, oh, can I make a speech at your wedding? And she said, yeah, I suppose you'll have to, won't you? But you know, it just... I think the expression she used was, well, I suppose we won't be able to shut you up. But this is a miracle, because you know, when I got into recovery, it was like my last warning from social services. Next time, she'll be taken into care permanently. And we've been through some hard times, because she had her damage and I had my damage, and we were like two children together sometimes. We have a really loving relationship now. And I feel really blessed for that. I have got a life beyond my wildest dreams, you know. But the best thing about it is, even today, how my life is today, I know that it will continue changing, that I'll continue growing, that I'll continue moving towards different things and new things. In the last few years, I've changed my job. I have a job that I really love now, and I'm very grateful for that. You know, I went into work on Monday morning feeling quite upset and miserable about all this, and then I got in my office and I sat down at my computer and I just had this thought, oh, I really like being here. I really like these people. And I felt really grateful for that. I'm grateful that I get paid well as well, but, you know, it isn't just about that. It's about feeling that I have a place in the world and that what I do can make a difference, a positive difference. And overall, I guess the biggest change is that I do feel that I belong somewhere, and I belong here with you, and I belong to a family. And my family is NA. My family is my friends. You know, I've been really blessed in that I have one or two friends who have been there since the beginning of my recovery. And so we've been friends for a long time now, and, you know, our children have grown up together, and that's like family. But for me, it's a family that I've chosen. It's a real gift. I don't think anyone outside of this fellowship knows how amazing it is that I can go anywhere in the world, and wherever I go, I can walk into a meeting and I can be with my family. And that's why I guess we are really lucky to be addicts. And I feel really grateful to have been able to come and share with you tonight. Thanks.
Thank you.